This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Jesse Cordier. I'm one of the pediatric radiology attendings at the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. On behalf of myself and my colleague, Jonathan Iris Wilbanks, we'd like to welcome you to our session of the Mini Medical School. For this session, what we'd like to focus on is pediatric radiology and how specifically we can help children navigate what may be a challenging experience through getting some radiology imaging and getting good pictures, as we would say. So what I wanted to focus on first for my half of this talk would be about what my role is as a radiologist, as a pediatric radiologist specifically, some of the things that we do, and then specifically some of the challenges we encounter. And then that will lead really into what some of the expertise and really outstanding work that Jonathan has been doing in the Department of Pediatric Radiology when it comes to child life services. So overall, my talk will talk about what is pediatric radiology, what do we do as a pediatric radiologist, some of the common challenges that we face when trying to do imaging in young children, and some of the solutions that we've done at the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. So what is a pediatric radiologist? Well, really, the first question is, what is a radiologist? This is a question that some people are not really sure. You know, what do we do? What type of experience, what type of training do we have? So really, my job is, we think of us as a doctor's doctor. We give information to other physicians about diagnoses. So if they think something's going wrong, there's a patient who has a fever and has a cough, we might get a chest x-ray. Or we might do things that are even more sophisticated, like a CT chest. We'll get the imaging that's obtained by a technologist, and my job is to interpret those images and to produce a report that we then is either relayed on the phone to the doctor, or when we also have a written document that's produced. So my job is to interpret this based on my knowledge of anatomy and pathology and all of these different things, and trying to put it all together. And often we as radiologists are the ones who are seeing things from a different perspective, and we often are the ones that put everything together and can really add and give a diagnosis. So I guess just as brief, radiologists, we have 4 years of college. We go to a medical school and get an MD or a DO. We do a one-year internship, four-year residency in radiology, and then plus or minus 1 to 2 years in subspecialty fellowship. That's what we do to become a radiologist or pediatric radiologist. In general, we, as a pediatric radiologist, my specialty is I specialize in imaging of children. So from fetal life all the way to adulthood, 18 years and older, these are my specialties where I focus on imaging and those things that are specific to growing children. They think about us as the generalist specialist. So we are focused in one area, which is the development of children. But again, we can see a lot of different things from head to toe. We work with lots of different things like ultrasound, CT, MRI. I interpret all of these different things. We also perform procedures. Some of the things that we like about us is that we get to subspecialize in things about pediatric radiology, but you're still you can see a little bit of everything, but you're still a specialist. So again, we really can image kids who really help kids who are very sick. And a lot of the clinicians we work with, very friendly. People in general who are working with children, really, I think you'll find, are some of the very, very friendly. It's a small, tight-knit community. So really a lot of things that appeal to me as a pediatric radiologist, the things that I like about the job, and the people in the community in general. And really, we enjoy working with children, and that's really the focus, and what we really enjoy is working with kids. This is one of our radiology residents. We're just doing some imaging of a child here for a VCUG, trying to encourage him to pee, putting his hand in a little bit of warm water here. So the trick actually works. This is our team in PEDS radiology. There's 4 of us here, and again, we're all certified in pediatric radiology. So I just wanted to go over, what's a common scenario? What would I do as a pediatric radiologist? And this is going to lead into some of the things of some of the challenges we might face. So for instance, there's a 6-year-old girl. She's been experiencing weight loss, having diarrhea, has a family history of bowel problems. So again, what my job would be, we do an image, we do an exam, an MRI. I interpret that examination, and then I look at the results, and I talk to the doctor that's ordering it, the GI specialist, the gastroenterologist that's looking at this, and I might tell them, We do some specialized imaging here. So, for instance, here's an example of an MRI where we get a look at the body, and we can actually look at the bowel and look at it as it's moving around. So this is a special type of exam that we do that we specialize here at UCSF at and in, and these are some of the images that we can produce. Here's another scenario, just an example. 7-year-old girl, high blood pressure, isn't getting better with medicine. So these things, as a radiologist, we start to think of this type of history makes us think, is there something going on with the blood vessels supplying the kidneys? So we have some special images that we can get that, as a radiologist, my job is to prescribe it. Just as if a doctor is writing a prescription for a medicine, I write a prescription for a special kind of test. And from that, we can get really good information about the blood vessels in the body and in the child. Something like this, we can get very beautiful, detailed images that can really help to answer a question that the kidney doctor might have posed. Here's another example scenario. 14-year-old boy, their chest wall is misshapen, something called a pectus excavatum. The surgeons need to plan for their surgery to repair this so that they can make the child's chest wall look normal. Often these children are actually teased a lot in school because they have very abnormal shapes. You can realize how sometimes very cruel children can be to one another. And so something like this, where we have a child with a very abnormal looking chest, this is a CT scan that we do. Again, we've prescribed the CT. From that information, I can show to the surgeon a lot of really detailed information about the anatomy of the chest. We can even show them what we call a body surface rendering. So we can give them even three-dimensional information about this and help them guide their surgery and target how they're going to do their intervention. So again, this is part of my role and my job, is to give really good information about helping to do those next steps. However, we'll talk about some of those common challenges. So here's an example that we showed earlier of that MRI. There are a few things about trying to put yourself in the mindset of a child, and even actually as an adult, there are a few things that are challenging about these things, like an MRI, like a strange environment, loud noises, small spaces. So for instance, here, MRI, imagine if yourself as a young child that you see something like this, and kind of a cold-looking, sterile environment with a lot of loud machines here, something to think about. And if we measure the sound levels of an MRI scanner compared to jackhammer or rock concert, they're pretty loud. So something to think about even as an adult, if you've ever been in a scanner, it's not something that's super quiet. A tight space, again, even adults can feel this type of claustrophobia, but imagine you're a young child when you have all of these things putting together. On top of that, you're sick. So again, this can make for a very challenging experience. And again, a potentially uncomfortable procedure, starting an IV. No one really likes getting an IV started, but imagine you're a sick child and getting this performed. You have all these put together, and this could result in these type of images. So again, you don't have to be a radiologist to see that it's going to be harder to interpret something like this compared to something that I showed you earlier. So really, what's important for me to be able to do my job well, to be able to help children, is to be able to have very good, clear images that we can do to guide treatment. So what can we do? How can we change an image like that to something like this, where, again, we see anatomy, we see things very well. So there are a few things. Again, these are our challenges that we have, and what can we do to try to make the experience better? So again, talked about our challenges. Let's talk about some of the solutions briefly, and this is going to lead into a lot of what Jonathan's going to be really talking about here, and these are some of our solutions. So just to include a little bit more, just as a specific example for MRI, we have this. So this is one of our MRI suites that at the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital here at Mission Bay. So we want to make the experience not this cold, sterile environment. So we've done these. This is part of the GE Adventure series. So all of our scanners have this type of material on them. So again, we have one that looks like a boat. We have one that's themed like a redwood, one that's themed like Yosemite. So these are all things. So it's palatable both for the teenager, but also for the young kid as well, where these things are trying to make the environment a little more familiar and a little bit less scary. We also have things like here with this almost futuristic-looking MR where it allows children to change the color, to change the themes that they see. They get a chance to be part of it and interact with their experience. Again, very young children having some, they're always being told what to do, but if they have a little bit of control over their environment, that really helps them master their experience. Also, we have things like MRI video goggles. So this allows a child to watch a movie and listen to a movie while in the MRI scanner. This is something, again, we sometimes say it's harder to get the kid out of the scanner once we've started watching these than it is now to get them in. Again, this is something that reduces that noise level. It lets them just focus in their own world with an experience watching. You know, they can bring their own favorite movie and just watch it, you know, Frozen or whatever they like to watch. This is something that really, I think, has really improved things. As just an example, we've been able to scan a child as young as 3 years, 11 months with no sedation, no anesthesia, just using these techniques. And that's our personal best. But you can imagine if you've ever met a child that young that it's really tough to get them to stay still. So the fact that we were able to do that, I think, is pretty remarkable.
How old is that child?
This child is about 5-ish, something like that, I think at that time of the picture. We have, on average, we've gotten pretty consistently scanned kids in the 5 to 6 year age range with no anesthesia. Four is pushing it. That really depends. As an example, in other institutions, some places routine 7 years and younger, you get an anesthesia, just general anesthesia, no assessment, nothing. That's all they get. They're going under general anesthesia. And we take the approach that we want to be able to have this child, you know, if they can get through anesthesia, that's one less potential for complications, one less potential for medication reactions. There's very early data that makes us suggest that there may be some long-term effects from multiple sedations for children for long-term with cognitive experience. So if we can minimize that and try to get them through without that and still get a great study, then that's something that we definitely want to do. And then, again, tailoring a little bit on the work of Jonathan with Child Life. Again, this has been, I've been in institutions where we do not have these things in place, and it's like night and day. As a radiologist, I'm trying to do my job in obtaining and interpreting the images, but at the same time trying to calm the child and trying to help them get through the experience. And with help of Jonathan and his colleagues, we're able to focus on doing our job and being able to obtain great images while Jonathan can help to put the attention on the child as well. So I think this has been really remarkable in what we've been able to do. In fact, we've just recently published a study where we put together all of these elements and we're able to get MRIs and MR scans of the bowel in children that are very young. And again, this is compared to nationally where they're done under sedation. And we just published our results of this, showing that we were able to effectively get great studies on very young children using these combination of techniques. And so, you know, what does this all result in? It really results in better patient and child experience. So, again, Jonathan will allude more to this, but if we can get a child through successfully, that makes that next time that much easier. So, again, this is something that we really want to improve. It also means better use of resources. So without having to use the resource of a general anesthesiologist, the time in the scanner as well, we try to use and maximize and save cost. And ultimately, overall, better care for children. So these are some of the things that I think that when we combine all of these, that I think this is really something that we've really impacted the children's experience. All right, so we talked about pediatric radiology, you know, what I do, again, trying to maximize our diagnosis for kids, some of the challenges that we face and challenges that are faced by kids in general, some of the solutions that we have in place here at UCSF. So hopefully we've turned an experience and we felt a little bit less like this to more like this. And this is my daughter. She's almost three now. With that being said, I want to lead into some of the more detailed work that Jonathan has been talking about some of the specific things and trying to learn more about his role as a child life specialist. So with that, I'd like to introduce Jonathan Iris Wilbanks. He's one of our child life services. He's our lead at and in charge at for radiology department and child life services. So again, thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you, Dr. Cordier. I think something Dr. Cordier really focused on was really getting those images to get that diagnosis, because When children come to the hospital and they need imaging, it's often because something is going wrong or they're sick or they can't figure out what's wrong. And these images and this data can really, really advance their medicine and really get them to a place where they're healing. But as you can imagine, how do you get those images when someone brings to the hospital all the fears and anxieties of a normal person? So that's where we come in. I'm a child life specialist. It's a very ubiquitous name. Most people have never heard of a child life specialist. My background is in development and psychology, and we're really looking at not just why is this person sick, this child, but who is this person? Who are they bringing with them to the hospital? What are they bringing with them to the hospital? How do they cope? What are their fears and anxieties? And I'm fortunate because I get to focus on that. So Dr. Cordier can focus on what he needs to focus on to get the imaging. So let's go ahead and start looking. So I wanted to start out by really coming to with a common definition of what fear is. Because we're talking about overcoming fears. So, an unpleasant emotion caused by the belief that someone or something is dangerous, likely to cause pain or a threat. So this is a common definition taken from a search. A more scientific definition would be a reaction to explicit threatening stimulus. So something that's actually threatening you, that's what would elicit a fear. With escape or avoidance, the outcome of increased cue proximity. Basically, the closer I am to this scary thing, the more fearful I am. And then this, I think, is really elegant, the unadulterated, ancient, possibly innate alarm system. It's something we all have inside us. We all can experience fear. And then an aside to that, what is anxiety? Because fear and anxiety are a little different, but they're related, and they both come into play when we're trying to help children get through an image. So anxiety seems to be best characterized as future-oriented. So fear is very in the moment. Anxiety tends to be that projection of future, of what's going to happen as this goes on. It's characterized by perceptions of uncontrollability. So I'm out of control and unpredictably. I'm out of control and I don't know what's going to happen over potentially adverse events. And then a rapid shift in attention to the focus on those dangerous things. So your attention is really drawn in that moment. That thing is very loud in your mind. You can't drown it out. It's saying, focus on this thing because it's dangerous. It's a more general state of distress than fear. It's longer lasting. It's prompted by less explicit or more generalized cues. So just something in the environment can cause anxiety to come on. Maybe the coloring of the room is wrong, or the person you met is giving you a bad vibe. That can increase anxiety, maybe not fear. And it involves physiological arousal, but often without organized functional behavior, which means I'm stressed, I'm feeling worried, but I'm not showing that in an organized way. So I think to sum it up, anxiety is really future-oriented. It has a lot of uncontrollability and unpredictability. And it's an emotional response to something that's happening, while fear is more in the moment. Something dangerous is going to happen to me right now. I need to protect myself. So with that, I wanted to take you on a tour, actually, of our facility at Mission Bay. This is our brand new hospital. We just opened in February. And I want to kind of put us in the mindset, if we can, of a six-year-old child. You just started first grade. You're really excited. You're out of kindergarten. You're starting to read. And it's your first real visit to a hospital. You've had doctor visits. You've had checkups. But this is the first time you're really coming to the hospital and something's going to be done. You're visiting radiology, and the primary thing is that it's been really painful when you go pee. So that's what you know. I'm going to the hospital. All you've really been told is, we're going to the doctor, we're going to get a picture taken. So you show up, and this is where you enter our department. So children's radiology and biomedical imaging. So you're a six-year-old, you're starting to read, and you're seeing these words, and you're thinking, okay, I don't really know what three of those words mean. I'm a child. But what is radiology? What is biomedical imaging? You're not sure. So right there, before you walk in the door, you've got a stress point. What is that? I don't know. Unpredictable. You walk in. So here's a waiting room. This was really designed with children in mind, and it's really lucky. The chairs are low. They're grouped together. Okay, I'm going to be able to sit with my person who's bringing me here, maybe your dad, maybe your mom, maybe your grandma. You come in, and you're going to come up to this check-in stand, and if you're six, this is what you're going to see. So, you know, as adults, we're used to standing here like I am above a lectern. I can look down. I'm at Subway. I can see what they're making. A six-year-old is looking at this wall. They see someone's behind that counter, and my parent is talking to them. And then, oh, it's Catrice. So Catrice is handing us our sign-in, and she's handing Mom a piece of paper. She says, fill this out and bring it back. You don't really know what this piece of paper says, but you're in school now, so you know, okay, it's something about me. What's going on? So you're asked to take a seat, and there's a TV, so you can watch a movie. So that's, you know, interesting. It's taking your attention away from this idea that you don't really know what's going to happen, and you're starting to get really into the movie. Oh, you've seen this before. It's planes. Oh, would you come with us? Movie over. Your turn. What does that mean? This is Diana. She's one of our nurses. She's going to bring you to the dressing room. So we enter our hallway. Where am I going? What is this hallway? What do these doors lead to? Oh, gowned waiting children. Okay, gowned. I don't really know that word. I know waiting children. Okay, I'm going to wait in here. I'm brought in. Oh, there's a changing room. Okay, I'm in a changing room. Oh, I'm going to take off my clothes and I'm going to put on your clothes. For a lot of children, this is a scary thing. This is unpredictable and you have no control over it. We're saying, here are our clothes, put these on. So you're changed and now you leave the waiting room and you're led down another hallway. Okay, where am I going? Still haven't really been told, but we get to this door and it says procedure in progress. Do not enter. But they're telling me to go inside. Okay, that's a little confusing. So I'm going to open the door up and okay, here's someone I've never met and they're wearing this big yellow something. I've never seen one of those. I've never been to the hospital. There's things hanging from the ceiling. I don't really know what that is. There's a couple little things on the wall. So there's, I see some octopuses. There's some, you know, but they're kind of hidden behind something. I'm going to come in with my mom, and now I'm looking around. You're six. You're going to explore the environment. You're going to be looking at everything. Here's a tray. It's got a glove. It's got, you know, something on it. I'm not really sure. Looking around. Okay, there's a weird chair. And you're starting to notice that there is a bed, and there's some towels laid on the bed. The next step, if you were the six-year-old and you were coming in, would be to bring you over to the bed and say, we're going to lie down on this bed now, or you're going to lie down on this bed now. We're going to use these towels to kind of hold you in place. No one has explained yet why you're here, what's happening. You just know you're having a picture done. So you lay down, and this is what you would look at if you were laying on this table. I see the octopus. There's a camera here, and oh, it comes over me. So now I have this large looming thing over me, and now the doctor's talking in the tech, and now they're telling me we're going to remove your pants because we're taking a picture of your bladder. I don't really know what a bladder is. And then the doctor is explaining, in a moment we're going to be placing this tube into your urethra. Okay, let's pause. How are you feeling right now? Yeah. So raise your hand if you're feeling a little anxiety. Okay. Imagine you're six. You don't have control. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know why we're going to place a tube. What is my urethra? No one's explained that to me yet. So how do you react to this fear and anxiety? How do humans react? Children are just small humans. So you're defensive and you're immobile. You're passive, but you're primed. So you're feeling like ready to jump, ready to go. You're freezing maybe in this moment. You might have an abnormally slow heart reaction, meaning you're kind of looking around, everything's slowing a little bit. You're hypervigilant. You are noticing everything at this point in the room. Anyone that moves, anyone that enters, anything that somebody touches, you're looking at it, and you're probably assuming that it's going to be used on you. You're going to get defensive. You're going to fight, or you're going to fly. So my job here is I'm starting to look for signs of fear and signs of anxiety, and we're going to be noticing these things in three ways. These are things that I'm sort of passively assessing for when I meet a child, whether it's in the waiting room before they walk in, or I'm walking in and this is where the child is at that moment on that table. I'm looking for behavioral or motor responses. Are they hiding? Are they running away? Are they covering their body? Lots of children will cover themselves. They'll pull that shirt real tight. Are they crying? Are they refusing? Are they cooperative? Would I be cooperative? So, bodily responses. So, you can tell someone's heart rate by looking at their breathing. You can see their heart rate sometime if they're hooked up to a monitor. They're sweating. Their breathing might have changed. And that's a subtle cue. Okay, this person is starting to get anxious. They're vigilant. And you notice this with children in hospitals. When you walk in a room, like the waiting room where we started, all the kids in the room will go like this. And they'll all look at the door right away together. And that tells me these children are vigilant. They're worried. You might have a cognitive, you might have a thinking response or a verbal response. You might say, I'm scared. You might start laughing. Many people, when they're anxious or scared, will start to laugh. And that can be misinterpreted as, you're good, you're happy. You might start asking repetitive questions. These are all things that I'm looking for when I'm assessing someone who's scared or might be scared or anxious. So I wanted to take you through some of the main fears. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back through that scenario. I'm going to talk about what would I do to get that person, that six-year-old, to the place of that table where instead of being scared, perhaps they're jumping on that table on their own. They're walking in that room confidently, and they're able to pull themselves onto that table. They know what's going to happen. So these are the main fears and anxieties of children. If you're an infant or a toddler, you're afraid of being separated from your caregiver. You're afraid of loud noises or sudden movements, large looming objects, maybe that x-ray that comes over you, strangers. Hospital is full of strangers. And changes in the routine. Going to the hospital for the first time as an infant is a total change in your routine in every way. For a preschooler, a 2.5 to a 5-year-old, separation again, the dark, noises at night, masks, anything covering the face so you can't see emotions you're going to be scared of. A lot of times in the hospital, people are wearing masks. They're covering their face. And you're starting to be afraid of monsters and ghosts and some imaginary things. And an especially risky thing about preschoolers is they have a very magical way of thinking, and they also have a strong egotism. Combine that together, they will make up things for things they don't know and assume that that thing is going to happen to them. So if they haven't been informed about something, they're going to make up what's going to happen and just assume it's going to happen to them. A school-age child, like we were talking about, is still scared of separation. John Bowlby, attachment theory, will say separation or loneliness, being alone, is the primary fear of all mammals. So it's still in there, separation or being alone. Being inferior or made to feel inferior, being made to feel like a failure, rejection from the people around you, a lack of industry. And what I mean by that is I don't have a job in this. I haven't been given a role to do. And I haven't had my autonomy respected as a person. You have a lack of control. That's a big fear. Injury, illness, doctors, shots, and death are major concerns and fears that are typical for 5 to 12-year-olds. Snakes and spiders. Very typical at that age. Teens, young adults, they come with their own fears and anxieties. Peer rejection, right at the top. They're really forming their identity and their identity within their social network. Bodily changes, they're afraid because things are changing and they don't know why. Threats to developing identity. So an illness or a new diagnosis could change how you define yourself. I'm a soccer player. Wait, but now I have something in my leg where I can't play soccer. Who am I? A lack of choice or autonomy in the matter. Invasions of privacy or control over your own body. Loss of newly gained independence and loss of important relationships. Major fears for teenagers. So here are some stress factors for kids in radiology. So we're looking at unexpected visits. These are things that are going to increase stress. Pain, illness, uncertainty, things we've been going over. Misconceptions is a big one. Children often come and they've made up a meaning for why they're there, and often it's very wrong. They know they need an IV. They've been taught what an IV is. It's a tube that's going to go in a vein, but they don't know where on their body it's going to go. No one's taught them that. So they might assume, oh, they're going to poke me in my belly because that's where the pain is. So that's a misconception, and that can be stressful. Physical constraint. Some radiological procedures require you to be constrained in some way, to have a blanket put over you, a Velcro seatbelt. In the old days, it was a blanket and tape. You were taped to a table, and that was it. And again, separation from caregivers. So that leads me to really thinking about what helps you when you're scared. So if we just take a second to really think about a moment where we're scared and think about the things that really help you in that moment to feel better or to start to feel better. And these are fairly general across a population, from infants all the way, you know, getting older. The same thing. So children overcome fear and anxiety through relationships. So the first question somebody asked was, is your parent there? Yes. So that's what we start with. Who did you come with? We're going to keep you together. So you walk in that waiting room on that visit. You're with mom. We're not going to separate you. We're not even going to bring her to another room without you for even a moment. You're together that whole time. It's familiar to you. That's your support. We're going to keep it with you. My job as a child life specialist is to come in and form a relationship with that child in the lobby. I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going to introduce what I do. And then I'm going to form what's called a therapeutic relationship. And that means I'm going to guide them through this journey, and I'm going to do that with trust, honesty, and I'm going to set intentions and goals with them, and then be really clear about when that relationship ends. So now I'm a relationship you have. You've checked in, and I come in and I introduce myself, and I start that relationship. We're going to give them knowledge, even a 4-year-old, even a 2-year-old. We're going to talk to them about what's going to happen to their body. We're going to familiarize the things. I do that with dolls. So I'll do that with play. Children learn through play. We all learn through play. Thinking about the things you really know, you've probably played a lot with those ideas at some point, even as an adult. So I'm going to come out. You've now changed. I've got my therapeutic relationship. I'm going to show you a doll with the same gown that you're wearing, and I'm going to start gently walking you through why you're here. I'm going to show you the equipment. I'm going to tell you about it first, then ask you if you want to see it. We might even play with this. I have dolls that actually have a hole, and we'll practice placing a catheter in a doll. Children will do that over and over and over again, and that repetition is allowing them to become familiar with what it is and what it looks like and what it feels like. Children generally fall into two categories. They're either info-seeking or they're avoidant. We'll find that out really quickly. And what I want to do is respect that. If they're wanting more information, I want to keep giving it to them at their pace. If they're saying that, I'm going to respect that. And what I might do is I might walk the parent out of the room if they have two parents so that we don't create that separation. And I'm going to explain step by step to the parent so that the parent knows what's going to happen and can support the child. I feel very strongly in my profession, and I think Dr. Cordier does in radiology, people have a right to know what's happening to their body and to have a voice in the decisions. So we give children choice through that knowledge, even small choices about the environment, maybe what color is that room in the MRI suite. So we are hardwired to react to the environment around us. If the environment is stressful, it's going to elicit stress in us. If it's calm, if it's peaceful, we're going to be calm and peaceful. So right away, walking into that suite where we went in and there was, you know, kind of stark walls, that environment is working against what I'm trying to do because the child's being stressed by the environment. So I have to counteract that. I placed, if you remember, the octopus on the wall. The octopus is in a position where when you were lying down, you can still see it. So we'll play a game. You know, how many legs, you know, what is it like to catch and eat? So I'm trying to bring their attention to something in the environment. And then we're going to plan. So you're in the changing room. We haven't gone to that room yet and looked. We're going to plan. I'm going to show you pictures of that room on the iPad. And we're going to point at the things in the room. So when you walk in there, it's familiar. And we're going to, now we've talked about what will happen in language that you can understand. We've showed you. We've practiced it. And now we're going to plan about how do you cope with that. Children pick this up right away. I'll ask them, you know, when you're hurt, what do you do? And we'll say, oh, I hold my blanket. Perfect. Do you have your blanket? Yeah. Well, you can hold your blanket if you're feeling scared today. Great. Now we've given them back their coping method. We're gonna make a plan. Often we write it down. You know, if you're feeling a little hurt, we're gonna do this. You know, you can put a hand up and say stop, and we're gonna listen to you. And the doctors and the technologists will stop. They'll step back from the table until that child puts their hand down. And we're gonna give them a little of that control in the process. Everyone gets a role. Dr. Cordier has a role. I have a role, the technologist has a role, the parent has a role, and the child has a role. Everyone has a job. And if everyone does their job, things go great. We get great pictures. And that's why the kid is here. And then the last thing is, you know, the title of this is Overcoming Fear. And really, that doesn't mean eliminating. Because remember when I was describing that tour, and at the end, everyone was feeling a little anxious? We really believe that that's important. You should feel anxious. Anxious and fear protects you. We don't want to remove that, because if you're not feeling fear or anxiousness, you're not going to protect yourself. So we're not trying to eliminate it. We're trying to overcome something. And when you overcome something challenging like fear, you grow. You come out of that radiology experience ready to overcome another situation because you have the tools and you've gone through it. So we have a couple pictures. So to support relationships, we're working in a model of family-centered care. The family and the child is at the center of this healthcare experience. And that's a shift in medicine over the last 20 years or so. It used to be very, you know, the illness or the doctor was at the center of the care. I'm at the top. I know better than you. We're really, I will tell a parent, I say, I'm an expert in children, but I'm not an expert in your child. You're the expert in your child. You're going to know when they're scared. You're going to know when they're not scared. And we need you at the center kind of directing us and allowing us to follow your lead. So you see in this picture, it's not just the patient. It's mom, it's dad, it's brother. Everyone is involved in that care, in that learning. And that's where we're really supporting that child. We're looking at preparation and education. We're preparing children for medical procedures or treatment. We use play. Children learn through play. We all do. And we're using easy-to-understand language. And I can demonstrate that by saying this is a catheter, or I can tell you that it's a soft tube that carries liquid to the bladder or to where your pee is in your body. And it's bendy. And would you like to feel it? So the child can play with it. They can understand what this is and not have a fear of it because they know it. They felt it. They've put it in a doll. So here's an example of environment when I was talking about. So you can see a little seahorse on the wall. Why would I put the seahorse there? If you're lying on your left side, because Dr. Cordier has now positioned you like this, you're going to be looking at this little seahorse. And it's not just one seahorse, it's two seahorses because they're together. They are, they're a pair. They're together just like you're together with your parent in this situation or with the child life specialist and the technologist and the doctor in the room. So we're pairing up the animals in the room to communicate togetherness. So now we'll talk about seahorses in this side. But like I said, there's a lot of things in the room. Specifically, do you notice the purple, yellow, and green? Those are oxygen, maybe nitrogen. Those are gas so that we can help a patient who might need oxygen. So I'm going to show you another picture, and it's another environment that we have where we do nuclear medicine procedures, and we also do very invasive procedures involving catheters. And just notice how you feel when I change this slide. Now, which room would you want to have a procedure done in? I want to be in there. And if you notice, your eyes are not drawn to that big scary thing in the middle. My eyes are drawn to the bear with the cub on its lap. My eyes are drawn to the fireflies above the bear or to the fish on the floor. And we've designed this table to be a sleeping bag in the woods. And it's hard to see, but right under there is a little squirrel collecting nuts, and he has a little baby squirrel too. So this room, I bring the kid in, I open that door, and the response is, wow. It's not... That child is prepared. We've looked at pictures of this room before we've gone in, too. And many times that child will know where they need to be for their picture because we've talked about it, and they'll climb right up on that table themselves. So we're really using the environment. And if you notice in the back, way in the back, there's little houses painted on the wall. There's a white one, there's a purple one, and there's a green one. Those are the same hookups. But we've incorporated it into the art. So your eye doesn't notice it and say, what's that? It's weird. I don't know what it is. It just says, oh, little houses. And you move on with your eyes. You don't linger on it. And that anxiety, again, brings a hyperattention. So this room is designed to lower fear and anxiety and stress. So we're planning. This is the last stage of the therapeutic intervention before we go into a procedure. We're introducing and we're reinforcing their coping strategies. Mom and dad's coping strategy with the child might be a bribe. It might be to beg them, which I wouldn't consider over the long term maybe a healthy coping strategy, but it works for that child today. We're going to use it because that's what you're bringing in. Or we're introducing some coping strategies. I do what's called a birthday cake breath. This is my favorite one. I teach it to almost every patient I work with, whether it's a 22-year-old or it's a 4-year-old. You take a big breath in your nose, and then you blow out birthday candles. And everyone can do that. It's very simple. It lowers your anxiety or fear in a moment and relaxes your body. So we're introducing some coping strategies, and we're planning on using them. One of the questions I get the most from kids is, will this hurt? And we plan because I want to tell them the truth, and oftentimes I say it might. I don't lie to them. I say some kids say it hurts a little bit. Some kids say it feels like a pinch. But what I do tell them, and I tell every kid who's going to go through something that's potentially painful, is I say, if you tell us something hurts, we're going to believe you. We're going to trust you, and we're going to do something to make it feel better. And let's plan on something that's something you can do if you feel something hurting on or in your body. So we're giving them that. That's their power. And sometimes they need a reminder, but it's something they can do. And then we're supporting them and we're empowering them to use them. We might be using redirection. I might be holding a Where's Waldo book. And that's something we've built into our plan. Or we're providing just the right amount of support that they need. Maybe they just need a handheld. Maybe they need the doctor to explain every little thing that they're doing. We're going to support them in their way. We're individualizing their healthcare. So the last thing with child life is we're always focused on growth and development. We're offering opportunities for play and self-expression to promote their normal development even after the hospital visit. So many children I will send home with a doll and a kit. And I explain to the parents how to do some medical play at home and incorporate it into their normal play routines. Because what I want to do is it's not just about this visit today, about getting through this VCUG procedure. It's about how do you access medicine in general? Do you feel comfortable? Do you feel safe? Are you empowered and do you know what you're doing? That can be just as important as getting through the visit today for a child is promoting that growth after they leave. So these are the benefits we see. They're trusting us. They're cooperative. It's not just getting them to do something. It's that they're a part of it. I've had children hold their diaper while the doctor puts the catheter in. I've had them count. They know. They tell the doctor when to do it. We have better psychosocial outcomes. What does that mean? They are feeling stronger in themselves. They have a sense of accomplishment. A prepared child is engaged, more compliant, better imaging. Engaged and compliant means faster and efficient treatment. If that's an MRI and you can get a child done in 30 minutes because they moved less, that's an extra patient in that MRI scanner. That's a lot of money for the hospital. Calm children means calm parents. Calm parents means calm children. So everyone gets that education. Everyone has a plan. It's not just the child. We're really working with that system. Better, clearer imagings. I can't emphasize it enough. That's really what we're there for. We want to get clear imaging. We want to find out what's going on. We're improving the patient and family experience. Part of the Affordable Care Act is a shift from medical outcomes to patient satisfaction and patient engagement. Almost like when you buy a car, many people now go to the hospital and you get a phone call. How was your experience? Can you rate it on 1 through 5? Families that are prepared and engaged, they have better experiences at the hospital. And then this is the big one, I think, is when you have great medical interactions, you develop trust in the medical community. You grow up as a person who can access healthcare for yourself and your loved ones in a way that you might not have if you grew up having scary interactions from very young. Many people are still very afraid of needles, and they can trace that back to a scary interaction. I have children who I work with who place 4 or 5 IVs on a doll, and then they walk into the IV room, even at 5, and they say, "I'm ready." And they watch it happen. That child is going to grow up, and when they need to have a blood draw done because they're feeling sick, they're not going to avoid the doctor. They're going to go in and they're going to get the health care that they need. And we're building those founding blocks of accessing medicine really early. So I have some more excited. And then I think Dr. Cordy and I have time to take some questions about how we do this at UCSF. So thank you for listening. And we're happy to go back to any slides or answer any questions that might have popped into people's minds. Yeah. Yes.
So yes, this the question, just to repeat for the audience and for everyone, the question was about related to growth potential for the radiology department, some of our various things. I can speak a little bit to that as I'm involved a little bit in this, but in general, so we have several different sites, and I think the idea is that we're really trying to evolve very precision medicine, precision in pediatric care, precision in adult and oncologic care, in mammography, in women's imaging, and women's services. Just was mentioned with Montgomery Street. Again, this is working with our colleagues in the community and the obstetrics and gynecology. Mission Bay, just from anecdotal experience and from all our clinicians, we've increased our business a lot more than we've anticipated, basically. We have 20 to 30% increase in ER volumes and in OBs. So, and I think combining with some of the remarkable work that Jonathan and his his team have done, and some of the things that are innovative, I think that just people see that and are very interested, and I think it's a good thing for everyone. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, I can speak to that. So the question was about radiology and its role in neonatology. So yes, we're very involved in that. We in pediatric radiology are also involved in the fetal imaging on that side. So even before birth, and we work then after birth closely with the neonatologists in interpreting all imaging for children. So we have routine meetings with them, with the neonatologists reviewing imaging. We've worked very closely with them in deciding what the best tests are and many of those things as we transition. Yeah, sure. So so the question was regarding training in imaging for medical professionals, specifically in the role of radiology and our involvement in education of other radiologists and future physicians. Yes, as one of the nice things about being part of the teaching hospital, we have a residency program in diagnostic radiology as well as a fellowship program in specifically pediatric radiology. I'm also involved in lecturing to medical students. So it varies by medical institution, medical schools, as far as what their exposure to radiology is. At UCSF, medical students are exposed very early on to radiology. So that's is seen as part of their anatomy course. So they're getting involved very early in about learning about imaging and that kind of a thing. Yes, and then we have a diagnostic, one of the largest programs in the country in diagnostic radiology and the top rated in the country in diagnostic radiology. So, yeah, we're definitely, as far as continuing medical education for other doctors, yes, we're UCSF and radiology department is very actively involved in education of the community. So we have many courses both nationally and internationally, which I'm fortunate to be able to speak at for these CME courses to educate other physicians who are in the community about radiology.
Yeah, so the question, highlighted that the slideshow brought up many people's own experiences as experiencing medicine as a young child, and then also sort of the importance of child life and then funding issues for child life departments. Is that about child life as a field has been around for about 50 years. It started with early studies in the 60s on children and separation in hospitals and what it was doing to them in the hospitals. And it was a lot of the attachment research through John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth was looking at children in hospitals. But over the years, child life has really had to find its place in the hospital and sort of fight to be seen as needed, as you were saying. I can speak specifically to our department in that support for what I'm doing and what my colleagues are doing from the top down is very high. It's seen as respected. We are invited to meet all of the incoming new doctors and give them tours and have them shadow us so that they see what we're doing and the impacts. Some hospitals, for example, Cincinnati has 80 child life specialists. So some hospitals have tied child life to research on patient satisfaction scores and seen such high increases that they're getting more insurance payback because they have such high patient satisfaction that they're using that to get more funding for child life. Child life in general is a master's level position, not a doctor level. And it is in the salary range of about a teacher. So that presents challenges for child life specialists in different areas of the country. Some child life programs are entirely donor funded, and some are through hospitals' full-time employment FTE systems. I think in general, child life is very established in many children's hospitals. JCO regulations say that a certain number of children coming into your hospital, then you need to have child life in that hospital. So that has helped us really gain a footing in the medical setting. But we're really, in some ways, working against old medical systems and old ways of beliefs about how children are treated. And we're lucky to have opportunities like this and opportunities with the doctors and with the nurses to provide workshops and continuing education about development. Many nurses come in without they don't learn about development of a young child. They learn about illness and how to treat it. So we can provide some of that developmental knowledge.
I also think, just to add to dovetail on that, is that I think thinking about it as an investment, we're investing in this so that we optimize our care, so that we have fewer repeat examinations, or so that we have a best diagnosis that we can possibly get. So I think the money invested in that program has really paid off. And if you had to choose between having some of the experiences without the child life and then with having someone like Jonathan who's dedicated and really focusing on thinking of the child's experience, I think it's definitely an easy choice.
And I think there was a question in the back, and then we'll get to you. Absolutely. So the question was, we were showing how beneficial this is in a radiology department, and the question is really, what does this look like in other departments of the hospital, maybe oncology, maybe a medical surgical, or even an outpatient clinic? Our reach is very far and wide, and part of our, even here at UCSF Parnassus, which is an all-adult facility, we have a small team who is referred out when an adult is at the end of their life, maybe through an accident or an illness. Child life can be referred to come in and explain to the children what is happening. We will do legacy projects where we're making handprints. We're talking with maybe the person who's dying about how do they want their children raised after they're gone? How do they want these things communicated? And then we're always looking at the child's experience, and we're able to integrate our developmental knowledge into that end-of-life experience to really make a powerful, developmentally supportive experience. So that's one way we're integrated. Child life specialists on oncology floors have a lot of journey. They join the journey with the family when a child receives a diagnosis such as cancer and really can help craft that experience for the whole family. And we are really integrated into each unit in a very different way. But the benefits are, from my point of view, just immense in almost every area where they've introduced child life. Yeah, the range of what we do is very wide. Sure, so the question is, have there been any studies on adults and receiving similar care as a child life specialist might provide, but to an adult in affecting their experience and hospitalization? My master's thesis was on environment and how environment impacts stress. And many of those studies were related but not exact that I did in my research about. They started in the 70s, I believe, with Ulrich, was a researcher who noticed the very beginning was patients in one area of the hospital had a window, and those patients got less pain medicine. What was going on? And from that question, they discovered that just having access to nature, just a window, they called the nurse less. They received less pain medicine. They went home earlier. Huge impacts, and this was just a window. And from there, the research really widened into the whole experience of a person in a hospital and all of the ways that the environment supports you. And one of the newest kind of areas of that are the relationships in the hospital. Some areas of the world, you go to the hospital and your dog comes with you. because that's a relationship you have. That's a healing relationship. So I would say the research is more an environment of care and how that supports you. Child life specialists are uniquely trained to look at that environment and maximize that environment and to work with the relationships, the lighting, the paint color, whether the TV volume is too high. Dr. Cordier talked about the MRI volume being about 100 decimals. Part of that research shows anything over 80 decimals is going to elicit a stress response in any human. So if someone in here were to clap very loudly over 80 decibels, all of us would have cortisol released in our brain and we would be a little bit more stressed. So going into a room beforehand, even for an adult, and saying, everyone, let's talk a little quieter. Let's turn the IV beeping off. Those are ways that environment of care and child life could specifically affect. So that's a good question. So the question is timing. How does this work with timing? And I think this is really unique in radiology because when you check into radiology, your appointment's at 8. And if you check in at 7:45, that camera is ready at 8, and they want you in there ready to go. So for some patients I meet, I've got 7 minutes to form that relationship, get them changed, prepare them, make sure they got to go to the bathroom, teach them about the room, make a coping plan. That's a lot to do in 7 minutes. Some patients, we have a half hour. Some we have an hour, and they've had a phone call from me the night before where I talked to the parent. The nice thing, and especially something Dr. Cordy and I worked on, is for some procedures, such as the one I went through, we've actually developed a plan with a step-by-step roadmap of that child's journey through the department. So they check in, the tech is notified, and the doctor and the child life specialist are notified. Now is the time for preparation. Now is the time for changing. The doctor isn't called to the room until that child is ready. And all of that is part of a roadmap that we've sort of worked together with the techs, with the nurses, and with family input to find out, is this realistic? And then that goes to the scheduler, who says you need to show up 45 minutes early or 30 minutes early for this procedure. So timing is really important. One thing that I do that I think a lot of child life specialists are focused on is when you're in the hospital, things feel rushed. But just through the tempo of your voice, you can make a moment quieter and slower. And then your question was to decrease downtime. I'll insert downtime. I'll say, I'm going to go check if the room's ready, and I'll be back in 3 minutes. And I won't go check if the room is ready. I know that the room's ready because I helped set it up. But I'm just going to stand outside the room for 3 minutes, and I'm going to let them digest. Because as you know, when you're in the medical setting, the questions that you might have don't pop up because there's so much information. So I might create some downtime to allow those questions to come to the surface. So timing is very important, and you can see timing and its effect on people by their stress and anxiety levels. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for our most invasive procedures like the VCUGs, the studies of the bladder, or things like that, we allow for extra time because of that in our scheduling and trying to put things in place so that that things can be efficient as possible. But as we mentioned, like, I think it's an investment. Those extra 3 minutes, it might delay the procedure by 3 minutes, but it's going to pay off because we're going to get the procedure done the way we want it to be done. So that's our different thinking on that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.